Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD HD. I'm Gregory Berg. Last week saw the death of William Passavant Roth, the age of 90. William Roth, or Bill Roth, as his friends and colleagues knew him, was longtime organist at Carthage College, serving Carthage for several decades. Bill Roth was a son of a pastor, a proud World War II Marine Corps veteran who then on the GI Bill studied at Carthage College for 2 years. That was back when it was located in Carthage, Illinois, before completing his degree at Northwestern University, before returning to Carthage to serve on its music faculty. And he and his family moved from Carthage, Illinois, up here to Kenosha, Wisconsin, when the college relocated in the early 1960s. In addition to serving as a college organist, he was also the conductor of the Carthage Choir for a time. In fact, he has the distinction of leading the Carthage Choir on its very first European tour back in the mid-1960s. Professor Roth played numerous organ recitals and hymn festivals all across the country and in Europe as well. It was something which gave him very, very great delight. And closer to home, he was the organist at Grace Lutheran Church here in Kenosha for 50 years. Bill Roth's funeral is later this morning at Holy Communion Lutheran Church in Racine, and I will be very honored to be part of it. I had the great pleasure of speaking with Bill Roth on several different occasions on the morning show. Today, in honor of him and memory of him, I want to replay our final morning show conversation. Today we're going to be talking about a different chapter yes. in William Roth's life.
65 and, years
yeah,
ago.
Yeah, a long time ago.
65 years.
Yeah, 65 years ago. William Roth and his experiences in World War II as a veteran of the Marine Corps as part of the 17th AAA Anti-Aircraft Artillery Battalion based in the South Pacific. And one of the reasons that we are going to have this conversation today is because earlier this year, back in April, I think it was, William Roth had the really special experience of being part of something called the Stars and Stripes Honor Flight, which brings veterans of World War II and also veterans of other wars who maybe are ill, especially if they are terminally ill, brings them to Washington, D.C. at no expense to them in order to give them the opportunity, first of all, to visit our nation's capital and more specifically the monuments and memorials that are there, including, of course, Arlington National Cemetery. So William Roth had that opportunity earlier this year and has brought with him all kinds of beautiful photographs and a couple of different articles that were written at the time of that visit to Washington, D.C., at the time of that honor flight. We're going to find out a little bit more about that specific program, and we'll talk with William Roth a little bit as well about his experience as a veteran. And, of course, this is the kind of experience that is important for especially young Americans, to hear and fully appreciate. So, William Roth, we welcome you back to the morning show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I know that we've talked about a lot of different history over the years. I think one of our conversations, in fact, was around the occasion of an anniversary of the beautiful Fritsch Memorial Cassavant organ at Carthage. And you told great stories about the transportation of that organ from
Montreal,
where it was built, hauled here in semi-trucks, and then reassembled in Siebert Chapel. And those are exactly the kind of stories that we have to make sure get
told and preserved, so those great stories live on. And this is a similar sort of thing. Ahead of us talking about some of this, I wonder if you could just maybe say a word about, in the wake of what you experienced in the Second World War, have you been the kind of veteran who talks about these experiences a lot, or over the years, have you actually not talked very much about what you experienced in the war? Because it's interesting how different veterans approach that question.
Yeah. I'd like to start that conversation of how long ago this was. It's almost another world for me. Because 65 years ago, I was drafted, one of the very few drafted into the Marine Corps. They were taking people in 1944 at the height of the Pacific War. They were taking them so fast. No choice. Lined us up in Milwaukee, and who wants to volunteer for the Marine Corps? Step forward. Two people step forward and say, we need 60.
Wow.
So 60 of us from the Nina, Menasha, and Appleton area were inducted to the Marine Corps then and there.
So it's not that the Marine Corps chose you, it's that you chose the Marine Corps, which is not always the way it works, of course.
That was quite an experience.
I suppose even when the Marine Corps is opening its doors to you, you know that that represents a very specific sort of gauntlet. I mean, to be a Marine means, in a sense, to undertake some of the most demanding kind of work that someone in the military can do. I mean, they have exceptionally high standards.
Yes, it was quite an experience to go to boot camp, and here the year before, in our high school at Nina, we had obstacle course, and all the different training for ROTC, and at that point. We ended up here being shipped to San Diego, and it was the same thing that we had in high school. We had the obstacle course, and we had all the rifle training. Huh. And so, actually, boot camp was not that difficult for me because we had already had all of that information.
Wow, you had tasted some of that. Now, were you 18 years old at the time?
I turned 18, and
Now,
they let me graduate from high school. My birthday was on New Year's Eve, and in June of 44, off we went to the war.
Now, at that point in time, if circumstances were different, had you not been drafted, were you already thinking about other plans for the future for yourself? I mean, and were you, for instance, thinking about college and studying music and so on? Or hadn't any of that really formulated in your mind yet?
Not yet. No. Things were moving so fast then, going into the last 2 years of the war, that that was not a consideration. Everything was towards the military.
Right.
From food rationing back home and many different things.
Everybody was involved in the effort,
right,
in the war effort. You didn't have to be a soldier to be part of this war. Yeah.
But after San Diego, we were all put on the ships. And I always say that someone was watching over me because I was behind an onboard ship with an attack transport always 2 weeks after the invasions of the different islands out in the South Pacific. But we were always backups. But I was very fortunate that way.
Right, because of course it would be the lead force that would bear the brunt of in terms of death and injury and so on. And
yes, I had some stories to tell on that one that I'd rather not.
Right,
because I was one of the fortunate ones.
Right.
So,
At what point did you know that your destination was the Pacific theater rather than Europe?
Right at the end of boot camp. We had a 10-day furlough which was quite unusual. They gave you the warning to be sure to be back after 10 days.
Hmm.
And it was 4 days from San Diego to Chicago, 2 days at home, and then 4 more days to get back to San Diego.
Ah.
And they came back just in time. And then, of course, we were on board the ships.
Hmm.
And I ended up in an anti-aircraft on the tiny island of Tinian, which was the world's largest airfield. On this tiny island, we had 4 runways, and all the B-29s were coming in then to do all the bombing of Tokyo. So that was when I was on guard duty. And the most exciting thing in my life happened right then was we were told that there was a big bomb that went off. And here we were guarding the Enola Gay, the one that dropped the atomic bomb, and we didn't know it. Our 17th anti-aircraft artillery was guarding the field where the Enola Gay was being secretly hidden. And when that plane came back, we knew and made the connection. So we all took our cameras and went up and took pictures of the Enola Gay coming back from the... Which that ended the war.
Right. But before it departed, you knew nothing about that then?
No. We did see the cruiser Indianapolis off the shores of Tinian and wondering, what's that big cruiser doing out there? Here it was unloading the disassembled atomic bomb right under our noses.
Wow. Oh, I see. And then it was reassembled under close guard.
Reassembled and took off, so... the tragic thing in all of that was another thing that was very hard for us, was that that Indianapolis cruiser took off for the Philippines right after it had unloaded, and it got sunk by a Jap sub.
Mm.
2 days later, after the war was over, it was right at the surrender time, so no one heard much about it, because surrendering to Japan was the big story then. But here we knew that 800 men were lost to the sharks.
Oh, it was a terrible tragedy.
Terrible tragedy. We saw that cruiser just before it was sunk. And
wow. And you're right. That's a story at the time that was largely lost to the public. And
but we felt bad about that. And
of course.
Because there were 1,100 of the crew that saved 300.
Mm. So you are guarding... First of all, the Enola Gay, although you had no idea at the time that you were guarding such an important ship. And then, of course, guarding the airship as everything else, including all these B-29s. How were you guarding them? I mean, with what kind of weaponry?
Well, we just had our M1 rifles, and we just had to be there and not let anybody near that particular area. That was all.
So it's
because we had thousands of us. For instance, each B-29 had a crew of 50 people just to maintain that one, and we had hundreds of B-29s. So you could figure out, one raid was 700 and some B-29s taking off 4 at a time down the 4 runways while we were on guard duty watching this with all that exhaust coming at us.
Wow.
Which you probably hear my little bit in my
I mean, what a sight, and it also, I mean,
what a smell too.
Yeah, that too, of course. So what was the specific threat against which you were guarding? Was it the possibility that Japanese soldiers would somehow enter the field
and there were 400 even after the war still hiding back in the jungles of Tinian.
Mm.
And they would try to steal our water and steal our food. And one of the most dangerous assignments that I had was being on patrol at 2 o'clock in the morning in the jungle guarding our water supply, because water was so scarce.
Mm.
And, of course, the Japanese had to have water, too. And we knew that there were 400 of them hiding out in the jungle that we couldn't capture. So
wow! So you are guarding the water wells or wherever your water was was stored. So
That was just
one of the things that I think is hard to imagine about that kind of work is that I assume that for long, long, long stretches of time, in effect, nothing's happening. And yet you have to somehow maintain your preparedness and your attentiveness. I mean, you can't literally or figuratively sort of go to sleep or even be half asleep. You have to somehow maintain that active presence. But I think a lot of us don't probably fully appreciate how hard that would be to do. Or is it that they were such a threat that it was easy to be wide awake and alert?
When you're on guard duty in the jungle at 2 o'clock in the morning, you have to have a password. And we always joked about the Marines in this. When you wonder if there's someone out there trying to get you, bang, you shoot first, and then you say, who's there?
Oh, dear.
So this sounds funny in a way, but it was a reality to us. We had to...
I mean, it underscores how dangerous the situation was.
I think that was the most dangerous. The other thing that was the most dangerous was a few days after the bomb was dropped, the second bomb at Nagasaki, they put us on ships, and we thought, oh, maybe we're going home. So the ship pulled out of the harbor. If it goes to the left, it would go to Guam. We might go home. If it goes to the right, it would go to Saipan, which is 2 miles away from Tinian. We pulled out of the harbor, and it pulled to the right, dumped us off at Saipan. So here the war is over, and we're still in Saipan 6 months. But during that six-month period, we had to flush out the caves of Jap soldiers and civilians. Would not believe that the war was over, and that was fairly dangerous. So 6 months after the war is over, they put us on the ships again. Ah, we're going home. No, we ended up at Guam. So we're at Guam, and the war has been over for 6 months. We're on Guam for 6 more months. So finally, after 1 year, by the way, we were building up GI Bill points all this time. Didn't realize it at the time.
For explain what that means.
The GI Bill was a college education, the best money Uncle Sam ever spent. But here we got on aircraft carriers that had been put with bunks, hundreds and hundreds and thousands of bunks on. I think we had 3,000 bunks on this aircraft carrier, and we headed for San Francisco.
At last.
At last. And boy, the tears came to our eyes as we came under that Golden Gate Bridge.
Sure. So
a year later after the war.
Wow. Yeah, I noticed that in the article and was kind of surprised to see that. That
in
you 1946. Served, yeah, June 1944 to August 1946. And, of course, it's absurd to think of, you know, VJ Day and then everybody just goes home suddenly. Of course, that's not possible. Oh. But for those of you where the war is over, but in a sense
there
not for you.
There was short of ships. There was 3 million of us out there in the South Pacific.
So just logistically getting all of you home was impossible.
Just getting home, no matter how many ships you had, it just took a long, long time.
Wow.
But we were happy to get home.
Yeah. Can I ask you a question or two about Saipan? This I did not realize was part of your experience there. That is this experience of flushing out the Japanese who were in hiding, and you said both soldiers and civilians refusing to believe that the war was over. And I've read some articles about this, about how for the Japanese they had this sense of, in a sense, invincibility. It had been sort of they'd been indoctrinated into this absolute belief in the rightness of their cause, and that there was no way they were going to fail.
Yeah.
And so here you are charged, you and your comrades, with...
Now, you must picture yourself as the north shore of Saipan. You had these cliffs and these caves the cliffs were way high and the caves were way high, and our patrols had to go into these caves that were up high. And this was where the stories came that people would not believe that the war was over. And they were told that the Americans would kill them and rape and everything else, and that wasn't true. So here we are with loudspeakers telling them to come out of the base, but they would not come out of the caves.
Hmm.
And a lot of them would jump to their death. And now you have heard of that, of course.
Yes.
And we were in that area.
Right. Now, so can you tell us what was being said over the loudspeaker? And I'm assuming whatever was being said in Japanese? I mean, was that...
I cannot tell you except that, come out, the war is over.
Right.
You will not be hurt. And
right. In Japanese, but I mean, somebody had Japanese, translated that into Japanese. And
yeah.
And hearing this, I suppose, they had heard all of these horror stories for such a long time and found it hard to believe. Although a few, you would have people that would come out. I mean... They didn't all ultimately refuse.
Very few, just a handful. And the same was true on the later battles, Iwo Jima and Okinawa. They would had been talked into you don't surrender.
Mm.
You kill yourself first, but you killed 10 Marines first. Then you'd kill yourself.
Right, so that's had to be frightening work. Can you just say a word, too, about... I always wonder what that would be like to be, for instance, an American soldier and suddenly be confronted by, in effect, the enemy, even though the war is over. I mean, in a sense, they are not the enemy they once were. The war is over, and yet... In some respects, first of all, they still pose a threat, and in other ways, too. I should think it had to be challenging for you as American soldiers to shift gears, in a sense, and to view these Japanese, especially the civilians, maybe, what to think of them, how to view them. Can you just say a word about that?
Well, I guess you are forgiving in a way, yet you can't be forgiving when you see the terrific atrocities almost firsthand. I did not, but the stories were there. And
right.
I had many, many stories and many pictures. In fact, my wife threw away some of the pictures I had that were just indescribable.
Sure.
And that was etched into our whole psyche.
Oh, of course.
I imagine in boot camp... we had to have very severe bayonet practice, and was a little hard to take at first.
Of course.
But I don't know how else to tell you, but the drill instructors had just come from Guadalcanal, our drill instructors, and they had terrific stories to tell. And they told us with a bayonet practice, you either kill or be killed.
Right. That can make the difference.
Yeah, you can figure how us 18-year-olds felt, you know.
Right.
By the way, our platoons in boot camp in 1944, in June, July, were 50% 18-year-olds. And the other 50%, which is very interesting, were all married men and 35-year-olds, you know, that was old to us then.
Really?
Yeah, because everyone else had been drafted before 44.
Wow, so it was this odd mix then of the very young and the very old.
Yeah.
Wow.
Go ahead with...
absolutely. Let me reintroduce for those that might just be joining us. We're speaking today with William Roth, who is a veteran of the Second World War, a veteran of the U.S. Marine Corps, and he's been talking about some of the experiences, some of what he saw and experienced based on the island of Tinian, later at Saipan, and then Guam, before finally coming home in 1946, ultimately going to Carthage College, from where she graduated, I think, in 1950.
Oh, I have to correct that. I had my last year at Northwestern and got my degree from Northwestern.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's right.
That's right. I just want to correct that.
Sure. So. No, that's fine.
But I had 2 years at Carthage.
Right. And then eventually came back, of course, to teach at Carthage for many decades with very, very great distinction. You ended up with a life absolutely filled with music. Bill, I just wonder if you could say a word about, because, of course, many, many veterans who came home from the Second World War, it was difficult. I mean, it was so much to take in. They'd experienced maybe so much pain and brutality and so on. And some people managed to begin afresh and built wonderful lives, and you, of course, are one of them. I wonder if you feel, in retrospect, that music was a very important reason or a very important factor in how you were able to go on with your life from there.
Yeah.
And in a sense, leave a lot of this horror and trauma behind you.
Yeah. Well, the first year, which would be 1946, it was difficult for me. I felt that I had lost part of my teenage years, and I had. I felt resentful for that, and I sort of felt the term have a chip on my shoulder.
Ah.
So those first few months before I started school, I finally weathered that. But after that, I went to Carthage, met my wife, got married, and everything was music then. I knew I was going to do this, and I was in Chicago for a short time. And Carthage had asked me on two different occasions to come down and teach, but frankly, the pay was so bad that I was making twice at a church job in Chicago. So I stayed there till 1957.
Before you finally began teaching at Carthage then.
Yeah.
And that's back
1957.
1957. And of course, that's back when Carthage was in the beautiful little town of Carthage, Illinois, and eventually moves here.
I came up to Kenosha in 1962.
Very good.
So I had the advantage of both a small college and the bigger school.
Right.
And then teaching.
Right. I so vividly remember having a conversation on this program with the great local musician Ralph Houghton, so admired and so missed. And one of the things he really conveyed was how when he came back from the Second World War, he really feels like one of the things that made all the difference in the world for him was that he could fill his life with music.
He's a prisoner of war.
Yeah, of course. I mean, so
he and I had some conversation.
Absolutely. And I think, I suspect that for both of you, music was a real healing agent in what came out.
We played tennis together, too. Ralph is a wonderful person.
Absolutely. Just great. So we need to talk about this great experience which you had earlier this year when you became part of something called the Stars and Stripes Honor Flight.
Right.
First of all, tell us when you first even heard about this and how long this program's been around.
Well, give credit to the television program. A year ago, my wife watched it, and on the program they talked about the honor flight on TV. And here was a group in Port Washington that called themselves the Stars and Stripe Honor Flight. And my wife took notes on it, and they said, if you'd like to sign up for this, please do. And they gave the information. At that point, I did not know it, but my wife handed in my name, and I got a letter back right away, and they said, you're going to be on the April flight
of
this year. And
your wife is a very take charge kind of person, and in this case, it worked out very, very well.
And I was thrilled about this. here was a one-day trip to Washington, D.C., and it was free, by the way, and to see the new World War II memorial that had been completed just a short time before.
Hmm. And I think I said it at the beginning, but we should reiterate that this program exists primarily for veterans of the Second World War,
right,
and then also for veterans of other wars who face perhaps terminal illness, and for whom this is also an important opportunity for them to travel to Washington, D.C. So how many of you made this journey to Washington back in April?
They sent us information. There were 200 of us veterans that were to meet at 5 o'clock in the morning at Mitchell Field in Milwaukee.
Hmm.
And have the one-day journey.
And were these pretty much veterans from Wisconsin and maybe northern Illinois?
Yes. Most of them were in the Milwaukee area. And
so this is this only kind of a local program? You mentioned Port Washington as kind of the base of operation. So this is not something that happens across the country? Or
this was one of the first initial ones. And since then, there are, I believe, 10 or 12 more similar organizations throughout Wisconsin.
Oh, okay.
And it's been catching on all around because there are 1,000 of us veterans dying each day, and their stories are going to be lost otherwise. And from what I saw and heard, it's a wonderful program because here we are, the vets with our guardians, flying and being together all day long and seeing all of the wonderful sites of the Second World War Memorial.
So explain to our listeners about this matter of the guardians who were part of this trip, in addition to the 200 veterans,
yes,
correct?
There are also 200 guardians. Each guardian was assigned to each vet. So my guardian was a nurse.
Oh, yes, a nurse from Delavan, I think.
From Delavan, Pat Corderay, who accompanied me. And most of us had wheelchairs. They had a wheelchair for me, but I was able to walk most of the time. But once in a while, my guardian, Pat, would push me around, and she took pictures. And the guardians were very, very helpful. And very much in need, I must say, because the first thing that struck me at 5 o'clock in the morning, arriving at Mitchell Field, one of my choir members, by the way, drove me, picked me up at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Wow.
And at 5 o'clock. But what amazed me were the number of disabled veterans in wheelchairs. There were dozens and dozens of wheelchairs at Milwaukee, 5 o'clock in the morning.
Wow.
Just imagine this.
What a sight.
And it took us 2 hours to go through the security. There's so many of us. It's just a huge amount, 400 on two jets that we loaded up and got going at 7 o'clock.
Wow.
Got into Dulles Airport. 2 hours later.
Of these 200 veterans, did you know any of them before this flight? I mean, did you know them from maybe veterans groups or events? Or were you really meeting most of these, I assume mostly men, for the first time?
Yeah, there was only one person. I'll tell you a little bit later about that one person. But most of them, none of them did I know. But I'm a member of the Gross Egerholm Detachment of the Marine Corps here in Racine. And I know a lot of these people. But I saw one of them, too, in the parade that you mentioned.
Oh, yeah.
Before.
Yeah, for our listeners, William Roth was part of a special float in the Racine 4th of July parade. A number of you who went on the Stars and Stripes Honor Flight,
right.
I believe, right?
Right.
Yeah, so it was...
But across the aisle from me, on the plane, all of a sudden I heard my name, which is pronounced Roth. This voice came to me, and he said, "You're a Roth." I said, "My pastor is Paul Roth. Is he any relation?" I said, "Yeah, he's just my first cousin."
Wow.
So here was one person that I knew on the flight. And Roger Sorensen, a Kenosha resident, went into the military in 1941, just prior to Pearl Harbor.
Wow.
He was in for years and years, and he was 95 years old, and I'm 85 years old. So I said, "You've got 10 years on me."
You're the spring chicken then.
I'm a spring chicken. But Roger had been in the Marines, had been in the service a long, long time. And we had a lot to talk about.
I guess. I think we should return to the matter of the Guardians one more time, because I think it's important that we explain where these Guardians came from. I mean, explain the process by which they became Guardians and the kind of gesture that it represents.
Well, going back to Port Washington, the Stars and Stripes had a list of volunteers that they put out the request for them, of course, and they had to pay. They had $600 each, but they have a waiting list. There's so many that want to be Guardians. It's just remarkable.
Wow.
But each Guardian stuck right with you and through the whole day and took care of your big box lunches and getting on and off the buses. I should bring you up to date on that. We got into Dulles Airport around 8 o'clock in the morning and got on these buses. There were five buses, and most of the buses had equipment for the wheelchairs, the lifts and that. And they took us on a tour, ending up around noon at the Arlington Cemetery, where we had our lunch on the bus, and there we were able to observe the changing of the guard. This was so impressive.
At the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier?
Right, because it brought me back 65 years to boot camp with the exactness of the military changing of the guard. All of the rifle platoon maneuvers, etc. And there we were right at the front line watching all these people going through the recognition of our dead.
Had you been to Arlington National Cemetery before?
I had before with my college students. In fact, a couple of times we on I did organ concert tours and took students with me. And,
but how powerful to be there with your fellow veterans. I should think that made it a different experience.
It was amazing.
Hmm. I know that part of this visit to Washington, D.C. also included a visit to the very impressive and poignant World War II Memorial, which, if I remember correctly, is a relatively new addition to the monuments and memorials of Washington, D.C. Tell us your impressions of that.
Well, that was two big impressions. One was, as I had a picture to show you, was of the pillar, if you call it, one pillar for each state, the 50 states, and this was across one half of a semicircle.
Right.
And these are tall, and the view from a distance was quite impressive. On each pillar was like Wisconsin, and then they would have a statement about its genealogy and whatnot. Then the other big impression I had was this whole huge display of crosses, gold crosses. There were 400 and some crosses, and each cross represented 100 that died in the Second World War. So we had 400,000 died or missing that are represented by this whole display of gold crosses, and that really says something.
It sure does, doesn't it?
You figure 400,000 were missing or killed. That's only second place to our Civil War of 600,000. And there was a plaque explaining all of that, which made a big impression on
us. I'm sure. I think that World War II memorial is, there's also, I mean, it's huge, and it looms above you, as you're right, but it's also very stark, which also conveys, I think, so well what it represents.
They had photographers there, many photographers, not just news. It was many locals and from all over the United States, and they took mass pictures of us, the 400 of us, big pictures,
right?
And gave us the assurance that we'd see those pictures later on, which they mailed to us.
So right.
I have a lot of that here.
Yeah. Did you see the other memorials and monuments as well? And if so, what are some of your most powerful impressions?
I had to stay on the bus towards the later afternoon, and Pat Cordery, my guardian, went ahead and took pictures of the Iwo Jima. Mm. I have one of the Iwo Jima float. One very unusual thing happened. On a plane going back home, all of a sudden, we heard the announcement to all of us, mail call. And to a veteran, mail call really means something.
Of course.
Because when you're out in the South Pacific, mail call was everything to us. And here on this, with all of us veterans on the plane, we have a mail call. Here are the volunteers. It must have taken them a tremendous amount of time to assemble a folder for each one of us. And in the folder was mail call from our relatives and friends and school children and
teachers. Oh, my word.
And, you know, for 200 of us, this was just unprecedented.
Oh, my gosh.
How they could do this and pull it off with all the volunteers, all the work that took.
Wow.
To assemble for each one. So here we are on the plane.
On your way back home?
On the way back home, all going through our mail, reading as fast as we can.
That's so neat, too. I mean, and what a great way to time it in that, I mean, the excitement of being in Washington, D.C. is over and done with. And, you know, you think, in a sense, it's all done. You're on your way back home. A sleepy, uneventful flight stretching ahead of you, and then this magnificent surprise is given to you. So this mail is from, some of it is from people you know and love and who love you, but then also from strangers? I mean, like school children?
High school and grade school kids writing a letter, dear veteran, you know, and we appreciate your serving, you know, it's It made a big, big impression on us.
What a fabulous idea.
But the word mail call, you know, that just took us by surprise.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But, there's nothing boring about the trip, though. From the moment we got on the plane, there was conversation just all the time on the plane, buzzing.
Mm.
But the most exciting part of the whole day still is coming.
Of course.
And I think you're going to guess what I'm going to say.
Go ahead.
So picture yourself on this plane at 10 o'clock at night. Suddenly, we're after mail call, we are approaching Mitchell Field in Milwaukee, and our hostess tells us to look out the windows. We're coming in to land, and we are all looking out the windows and imagine the sight. Here are thousands, I'm not kidding, thousands of people out on the runway, out in the aisle, just everywhere.
At 10 o'clock at night.
Complete families. And there are fire engines shooting water in the air. There are sirens sounding. And there are just people everywhere. Police patrols. And the police had to make pathways for us going off the plane. So with all this turmoil going on, here there are three different bands playing, and there's a bagpipe band, and there's this narrow pathway with police holding the people back, trying to reach us, saying, thank you, thank you.
It's amazing. And they kept this.
It brought tears to our eyes.
Sure. And they managed to keep this a surprise. I mean, none of you had.
A complete surprise.
None of you had any idea this was going to happen.
But the people, there were thousands, not just 1,000. They couldn't keep count. All reaching out. I never shook so many hands in all my life.
Wow. What an amazing way to. And again, you know, just when you think the excitement is all over.
You never forget this. It just,
wow.
And it was complete families. So some of the 4-6-year-olds. It took an hour and a half, almost 2 hours, to get through that maze of into the airport and meet our hosts. The family that brought me brought their family at the end of the line. And brought me back at midnight. So that was something we'll just can never forget.
Wow. Well, whoever has created this Stars and Stripes Honor Flight program deserves a huge pat on the back. I mean, what a marvelous gesture. And it sounds like right down to the last detail, it's done so beautifully. And I'm sure you look back on that long day with just the greatest sense of gratitude and delight.
We entered. They gave us the jackets to everyone, the 200 jackets.
Oh, I see that. And there's a beautiful emblem which says Stars and Stripes Honor Flight. And below it, Bill, can you... Operation Resolve. And then you are wearing from... the Egerholm Gross Attachment 346 of the Marine Corps League of Racine, Wisconsin. So you are decked out in all your proud regalia. Oh, and then your official name tag.
At 5 o'clock in the morning, you don't know where you're going.
or who you are.
They were so well organized. I just can't believe how you can control 400 people on two big jets and at 5 o'clock.
Wow. Well, we're glad you got there safe and sound, returned safe and sound, and that this was such a heartwarming and meaningful experience for you. William Roth, a veteran of the Second World War, we appreciate this account, and we hope that for many other World War II veterans in the months to come, they will be able to experience this as you did, a Stars and Stripes honor flight to our nation's capital. William Roth, I so appreciate you joining me today on the morning show to tell this great, great story.
It's been a pleasure sharing this information.
That was a conversation that I was privileged to have with William Roth, Bill Roth, several years ago. To take us to the top of the hour, here is a brief memento from Bill Roth's long career at Carthage College, from his time leading the Carthage Choir, and a performance of A Mighty Fortress Is Our God.